Diouf at pace.
Watch the movement of Gil going to the far post.
He rose so high.
The High Performance Show with Chris Appleford, Bill Tate and Keegan Ziata on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Welcome to the High Performance Show here on FNR, Football Nation Radio. A big show ahead for you tonight. We're going to be talking about all sorts of things, sports science, that affect you as a footballer. Right off the top, well, we had some tragedy in the world of football last week. David Astori, the captain of Fiorentina in the Serie A, died in his sleep from a heart issue. We're going to dissect that a little bit later on in the show. The what the reasoning was, what the cause was, and whether athletes should be worried about that. And then we're gonna change tack, and I don't know how to put this, but we're going to worry a lot of footballers out there, I guess, because we're talking about booze, talking about alcohol. We're going to talk about how that affects you as a player. And look, I know that you know that it affects you as a player if you're boozing on a Friday night and you're playing Saturday morning. Sure, we get that. But there are many, many other ways that boozing affects you as a footballer, and we're going to go through those as well. Then we're going to go to North Queensland, up to Townsville, James Cook University up there. A guy by the name of Anthony Leakt, Associate Professor Anthony Leakt, has done a research paper on the key team physical and technical performance indicators of team quality in the Chinese Super League. So basically, what technical and what physical attributes do the top teams exhibit at the end of a season and the bottom teams exhibit at the end of a season, and it nails down what your team needs to do or what your team needs to work on, what needs to be good at if you want to finish at the top of the ladder as well at the end of your season. So that'll be a very interesting conversation. But first, my co-host, as always, Bill Tate, welcome back.
Thank you, Cactus. Good to be back.
And Keegan, you're in the house again. How are you feeling? You good?
I'm feeling good, Cactus. Excellent. I'm wearing a jacket today, so feeling good.
I'm just glad you got something on up top, you know. It's just
yeah, that was awkward last week.
I know, it's not right. Especially
awkward.
When he's all sweaty and, you know.
Yeah, okay. Some people like that.
I know. Anyway, hey, let's get to it. Let's talk about David Astori, the Fiorentina captain who died last week. It was a tragic death a couple of weeks ago, died in his sleep. Now, the Udine public prosecutor, Antonio Di Nicolo, has confirmed that his heart gradually slowed to a stop due to bradyarrhythmia without any external causes. Can somebody on this panel explain how your heart can simply slow to a stop?
Well, I think there's an urban legend that this is what happened to Bruce Lee, right? You know, there's this story. I think the athletes can have all sorts of problems with their hearts. And I think specifically around this sort of incident where you have a sudden issue with a heart, it's not a heart attack, but in a sense it's like a cardiac arrest where the heart either goes into an abnormal rhythm that it can't get itself out of, or it stops functioning properly and part of it stops getting blood flow and that sort of thing. It can actually be caused in athletes because, as we mentioned last week, the heart is a muscle, just like every other muscle. It's a different type of muscle in that we don't have conscious control over. It's an involuntary contraction, but it's still a muscle. And the same mechanisms that cause muscles to grow, and the growth of muscles is usually called hypertrophy, mm-hmm. and that's, you know, hypertrophy training. Anyone who does
weightlifting
and that sort of stuff will have done that. Keegan does it all year round.
Yeah, he's doing it now. He's doing bicep curl as we speak.
Sorry,
put that dumbbell down.
So the muscle, your heart muscle, will grow in size the more you use it. And athletes who have high load on their heart muscles will suffer, in inverted commas, from muscle hypertrophy. Now, that can be a really good thing a lot of the time, because a stronger, larger heart muscle in a normal human being will mean more efficient pushing of the blood around like a pump. It will mean higher blood volumes. The difficulty that happens is it gets to a point with a heart muscle, say somebody who already has a pre-existing large heart, like a large person, a large human.
Like you?
Like me, yes. if their muscle grows large enough, what ends up happening is the muscle is innervated by a series of nodes of nerve endings that send a pulse of an electrical impulse across the muscle, and that's what causes the four chambers to beat in a rhythm, and it needs to beat in an order as the electrical impulse travels across the heart in order for it to pump from one chamber to the next to get it to pump through the circulatory system and through to the lungs, the way it works. If you imagine that little part of the heart where that node, where the signal comes out from, gets spread out because that part of the muscle gets bigger, then the actual impulse gets spread around and might not actually be as targeted, and it can cause it to misfire and fire in a sequence that's not appropriate for a normal sort of heart rhythm. And that is actually relatively more common in highly, highly trained aerobic athletes. And it's sort of close to my heart, if you like, because I suffer from that as a former elite aerobic athlete 20 decades ago. Myself and a lot of rowers who are very big humans,
yep.
When our heart muscles grow, we tend to have a high proportion of rowers who end up suffering this kind of issue. The Baker Institute actually in Melbourne is halfway or partway through, 1 year through, doing a 50-year study on these arrhythmias at the moment, and it's a very serious thing, and it's part of the reason why at the moment every athlete that wants to compete in an event at a world level will usually be asked by their national federation, so FIFA in this instance, to have had a heart echo to clear that they don't have an underlying problem with these rhythms. Now, unfortunately, in this instance, either it hasn't been picked up or, you know, changes have continued to happen. And it's definitely something that you have to be mindful of, but it's not like a ticking time bomb for every athlete.
Yeah, a lot of them are asymptomatic or very mild, so you wouldn't even know that you had it. And that's why, I guess, going back to assets, you know, these guys are worth millions, why clubs are investing in these medical screens and to identify that. And we've seen in the past, in the last probably few years, it's becoming more and more. You know, you've seen, I think, Mark Vivian Foley from Cameroon a few years back was the same. There's a pretty disturbing picture of him on a stretcher. With his arm. And then there was a guy for Benfica, I think, Miklas Ferreira was another one who came on as a sub and within a few minutes just slowly collapsed. So, yeah, it's really interesting when you think about these athletes who train year-round being really healthy and really it almost fit. Becomes that diminishing return.
Too healthy.
Almost, yeah.
But it's not something that everyone is likely to suffer. You have to have some pre-existing
genetics and
conditions, and not necessarily conditions that are bad. You'd have to have a set of conditions, like a large left ventricle, which is one of the chambers of the heart, is a really common thing. And the good news is that if you are identified as being at risk, there are a number of things that you can do. So you can actually go on drugs that will help manage abnormal heart rhythms and other things that are related to cardio hypertrophy. And I'm on a drug that does that at the moment. So that's something that can actually help people live very normalized. But they can also do ablations, where they will send a hot, essentially almost like a soldering iron, a mini soldering iron, into your heart and actually burn nerve endings that are in the wrong places that are sending the misfiring sequence through the heart. And I know quite a few top-level athletes, like Olympic medalists, that have had that done and gone on to be very successful. So it's not a ticking time bomb. You have to have a pre-existing sort of set of conditions that are not necessarily unhealthy conditions in any way, but they'd be underlying things. And they're... Once people are screened from them, generally, it's pretty easy to pick up, I think, whether people are susceptible and likely to have an issue. Unfortunately, these things are going to happen from time to time. It's just shocking for us when we see someone at the peak of their powers undone in something that you think, wow, that never happened to them. But unfortunately, elite athletes, they get cancer.
Yep.
They suffer from some of these sort of pre-existing genetic conditions. Some will get diabetes. All the things that just affect populations, they're going to affect elite athletes at a much, much lower level, but it's going to happen. And it is very shocking when it happens to, I think, the general public. But it's not a reason to be concerned about being healthy and fit.
Bill, were you always asymptomatic and never really had any symptoms, or did you experience some?
Knowing what it is, I probably had it from school. I certainly had it all through my rowing career. It wasn't until after my rowing career that I had a really severe episode and had to go to hospital and had a cardioversion where they sort of they basically put them on the table and they get the paddles out and they shock your heart back into rhythm. And I've had that done a couple of times to get it to that point. And unfortunately for me, the issue with my heart where the nerve ending that's innervating the heart in the wrong way, it's an area they can't ablate, so they can't send the little soldering iron in there and kill that nerve ending. So I just have to live with having an arrhythmia drug once a day. But it doesn't affect me at all, you know. Like I train, you know, I do absolute top end exercise, and I do you know, things to a level, well, certainly inferior to what I was when I was an athlete, but I would be able to if I was able to get myself back into that sort of shape. So it's not something that can't be managed by any means.
So when you said there was a range of contributing factors for Astori, there was a quote from De Nicolo, the Udine public prosecutor. He said it was most likely a Brady arrhythmia with pleurivisceral congestion and pulmonary edema. Now, I did some research.
Yeah, because
I had
a lot of words.
Yeah,
there, isn't
no
there?
Idea what
I can
meant.
Break that down in some words. Edema, swelling, and
well, Brady arrhythmia is a slowing of the
down.
Heart.
Yep.
Pleurivisceral congestion. I googled, and there was literally zero about that. But then I sort of broke it down even further. Pleury means combination, and visceral means internal organs of the chest or abdomen and or abdomen. So I guess a combination of issues or congestion issues in the organs of the chest. And then pulmonary edema, or wet lungs as it's often known, is excess fluid in the lungs. So there was a few things going on there for him.
Yeah. So, and that's interesting. So what it's sort of indicating is he may have been suffering from like a bronchitis-y sort of condition, which has obviously strained his body's, you know, you can imagine if he had a pre-existing sort of semi-heart thing, like yep. Whatever it is, and then he has fluid on the lungs from a cold that maybe has sort of gone towards bronchitis, maybe not quite to pneumonia sort of state. He's not actually getting the oxygen in,
yeah.
So his heart's then actually sucking harder. The heart would be sucking harder at the blood coming through from the lungs, and that's obviously going to put a lot of strain in it. It sounds like, from what the prosecutor said there, that it is that classic one of a combination of a whole lot of things going wrong at the wrong time to lead to a disaster, unfortunately for him.
So just for our footballers who are listening in, A, should they be worried? B, is there a test? Should they go and get tested? Or is this just one of those things that happens and, yes, we're shocked, but don't worry about it?
Look, I think heart health is something everyone should take seriously, but the best thing you can do for your heart is to have a healthy cardiovascular system by far. So 99.99% of the time for anyone, that's going to be, you know, improving your cardiovascular system through regular exercise is going to be the main thing. The second thing to recognise is an elite football player is not an everyday athlete. Like, not only are they training very hard and in competition times constantly trying to recover from extreme bouts of exercise, they're also travelling and doing a whole lot of other things that add a lot of stress to recovery. So they're at the end of the spectrum that, you know, probably hardly anyone that's listening to this show is going to actually experience. So I would say with those two things in mind, no. But if you have a pre-existing heart condition and that sort of stuff, you know, we would always say that you do exercise under medical guidance. And I think that's really sensible.
Yeah. I think even looking into family history as well, I think that's a big one. Look into your family history. Yeah. If you've got if it goes down the heritage, I guess, of family, then maybe it's something to look into. But
and these things usually do.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break now. After the break, we're going to talk about something that might scare a few people out there, men and women. If you're a bit of a booze hound, I don't know whether this is the time you should be turning off for 15 minutes or whether you should be really listening in and taking notes.
This is like chocolate last week, isn't it? You are shattering dreams, Cactus.
Just shattering dreams, exactly. We're going to talk about how alcohol affects performance and recovery right after the break. This is the High Performance Show on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Hands deal at pace. What's the movement that feel good to the far post?
He rolls so high.
The High Performance Show with Chris Appleford, Bill Tate, and Keegan Ziada on FNR Football Nation Radio. Stepping up, game on, game on, game on.
Welcome back to the High Performance Show. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at FNR_radio. You can follow me at Chris Appleford. You can follow Bill Tait at Roe Tate, Rowtait. You can follow Keegan Ziada at KZIADA7. Good chat earlier about heart conditions, of course, with David Astori, the captain of Fiorentina, dying a couple of weeks ago of a slowing of the heart. What the public prosecutor in Udine termed bradyarrhythmia, which is just slowing of the heart until it stopped, which is a tragic situation. But for all of our footballers out there, you have nothing to worry about. The best thing you can do is keep training hard, keep working hard, have a solid, healthy cardiovascular system, and you'll live a long and vibrant life. Now we're going to talk about booze.
Jeez, that swung quickly, didn't it?
If you overindulge here, you will not live a long and vibrant life.
Escalated very quickly.
You might live a short, eventful life, but if you want to live a long and vibrant life, an active life, then you might want to get your booze under control if you haven't. Now, I've got some stats for this. I want to put it out there that I'm a non-drinker. I don't drink alcohol. I used to, but I don't anymore. And these stats frightened me when I read them because Australians 15 years and over are drinking approximately 9.7 litres of pure alcohol a year. Now, to put that into perspective, if you were to divide that evenly across the four types of drinks that drinks are generally categorised into, that means every Australian that's 15 years or older, every week, is drinking 5 beers, a bottle of wine, 3 mixed drinks, and half a cider. Every Australian in Australia, Australian 15 years or over, is drinking that much every week.
And I think we're only like 25th in the world or something. We've got to lift that game. Sorry, I take that back.
Now, to give you another perspective on it, that is an extra 1,650 calories a week. Mm. So for a woman, that's basically a day of eating.
Yeah.
For an average man, that's almost a day of eating.
Wasted calories.
Calories. And to put it into another perspective, it's between $1,300 and about $5,000 a year on booze. So a lot of money.
Mm.
But we're talking about how it affects footballers. So I've got 6 areas that alcohol consumption can affect us as footballers, and I just want your thoughts on them and how this affects soccer players out there. So how does booze affect your immune system?
Yeah, okay, so it obviously compromises your immune system. It raises your susceptibility to illness and infection and that sort of thing. And it does. I think it does that in a number of ways. It obviously, first and foremost, a lot of the capacity of your body to cope with something is actually going to cope with synthesizing alcohol. So it, at a very fundamental level, it lacks the energy then to fight infections and those sort of things. And because alcohol does take quite a lot of focus and effort to actually deal with, so that's going to be one of the areas. But also, I think it also relates to the fact that drinking alcohol tends to, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, tends to lend you to making poorer decisions about some of the lifestyle things that you do. So you leave yourself more susceptible to environmental issues that can trigger health problems.
Like risky behaviour.
Risky behaviour, but also environments like, I mean, at a very fundamental level, like I read a study once that said that people who are drunk, that are beyond a certain point, I should have looked up exactly what this is, they leave their mouth open for longer, right? which affects the mucosal membranes at the back of your nose and your mouth, which are really critical in terms of your first defense to upper respiratory tract infections. And that's one of the reasons why when people fly, we've talked about this, you'll often see them with the humidifier masks to try and stop that from actually happening.
Yep.
So that's a funny thing. Like, I always think about that when I'm out with mates and stuff. And
you know, just tell people to shut their mouth
for longer. Yeah. So there's a whole lot of little things that lead to that.
And of course, if you've stressed your body out playing a game of football and you've been boozing and your immune system is lowered and you're at home trying to recover, your recovery is definitely going to be compromised. Okay, Keegan, your turn. How does booze consumption affect hydration?
Well, it acts as a diuretic. So it I guess, promotes the removal of water and salt within the body. So you through urine, obviously, so you want to pee more. So it doesn't help with that recovery and that maintaining or rehydration, which we've talked about in the past.
It's interesting because you drink, 3 litres of beer and you're actually doing your hydration a disservice.
Yeah, absolutely.
You'll pee out much more than that 3 litres.
Yeah, and the thing is, this is often at more the local and community level. It's part of, I guess, what you might call tradition or part of the culture is, okay, we played, make sure we head back to the bar and have a beer or two.
Yep.
And, it's obviously prolongs your ability to get ready for the following week.
Yep.
And I'll throw in there, I shouldn't, but one of the tricks that used to happen, doesn't happen anymore, but when you'd get drug tested after a sporting event, particularly after an event where you'd be dehydrated naturally, it's very hard to pee. Mm. It's hard to pee in front of someone sometimes anyway, but one of the things people used to use was to have a few beers to get the system going.
Yeah.
We used to have to do that. We had to do that in college, and sometimes you'd be sitting there for a few hours just...
Getting wasted.
Just drinking. Yeah. Maybe not beer, it was water, obviously, but... Yeah, until you could actually pee in front of someone.
Yeah.
And then you've got the person standing over your shoulder, which only adds to the challenge.
Adds to the anxiety. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
All right. Sleep, an obvious one. Bill.
It relates a little bit to what we just mentioned. So obviously quite often you'll be interrupted with more frequently getting up to go to the bathroom, so you're not going to sleep as well. Your body is working to metabolize and synthesize the alcohol, so it's then also going to be working at a higher rate. Your metabolism is going to be up, so you're not going to be as rested. And it can cause changes in your blood pressure, which can affect your... circadian rhythm. Sorry. So that can affect that as well. And this is another one that goes back to the same thing. When you sleep, apparently the same deal, you'll quite often sleep with your mouth open the whole time. And no joke, I'll look it up and bring it in. There's a study that shows that actually is a factor with upper respiratory tract infections. So it does affect your sleep for a whole lot of little reasons.
I think Bill makes a good point there because have you ever, not that I do, but I'm sure when you go to bed, once you've been on the drink and you wake up, you always seem to get up early, even though you've gone.
Yeah.
And it's because the alcohol is the depressant, so it slows your heart rate. And then all of a sudden when your heart returns to normal rate, it's that little bit of a kick and you start, so you're up and about so that actually interrupts your sleep. So, you know, you might have gone to bed at 5 o'clock and had 4 hours sleep in the first bit, you wake up and you're full of this energy and then you crash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if you're out there thinking that a couple of beers before bed is a good way of getting to sleep and having a nice night's sleep, it's not. Your body is working overtime, metabolizing alcohol while you're sleeping. Okay, protein synthesis in recovery and adaptation after strenuous exercise.
I think that fundamentally alcohol is utilized as an energy source in preference to protein. So it will get metabolized first ahead of protein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it affects your body's ability to be able to utilize protein to start rebuilding muscle fibers, amino acids to rebuild muscle fibers. So yeah, it sort of almost circumvents your ability to actually use protein and to rebuild.
So if you've had a strenuous game, which is no doubt you have, if you played football for 90 minutes and you've worked hard, then going out on the booze is not going to do you any favours for recovery in terms of protein synthesis.
And not even games, just in terms of training as well. Like during the preseason, the adaptation that you want from the training, adding that stress, it will inhibit the adaptation and the development that you want them to be gaining, I guess.
Yep. All right, Alf, the second last one. And every man's favourite, testosterone secretion. How does alcohol affect testosterone levels?
Well, it suppresses the release of testosterone or the generation of testosterone as well, which we've discussed many times is a really important performance factor. But, you know, it's not just a performance factor for men. It's a health factor in life. So it would certainly be an issue. I think that's something that you would be concerned about. If you were, again, though, I think we'll make this point at the end. we're not talking about if you have the odd beer here or there, and, or one night with a few drinks with your mates every so often. This is like ongoing.
Yeah. I think there's actually some research coming out recently. This might be very contradictive, but I think it was an Olympic organization that were looking at beer post-exercise for recovery.
Yeah, right.
And I read it somewhere a couple of weeks ago.
A beer or two actually helps.
Yeah, they're trialing it, I think.
they're trialing it.
The difficulty is, though, like, beer is not beer. Like, there's so many different types of beer. And there's some beers that are rich in certain things.
Well, they're actually looking at non-alcoholic beer.
Yeah.
Might have a recovery benefit behind it. I might find it and retweet it somehow.
So if you want to maintain basic levels of testosterone, don't be a booze hound.
Don't be a booze hound and make sure you hit the gym and maybe do some really high-intensity exercise.
Yep. Last one, the injury recovery rate and the outcome of your injury recovery.
Yeah, that's a big one. I think you see that there's been at times, and I know where in games you'll pick up a little niggle or it might be a corky, and you wake up the next day without even drinking alcohol, and it's worse. You didn't even realize that. It's like, oh, wow, I didn't even realize I had that. That is only going to make it worse because it's increasing the blood flow, which then is, I guess, promoting the inflammation process and bringing blood into that site in the inflammation area.
Alcohol is a vasodilator, so it causes all your blood vessels to open. So if you've got an underlying bruise, it's going to get worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it slows down your recovery rate, and when you do recover, you probably haven't recovered as well as you could have.
Yeah. I think at the top level, there's a lot of the elite programs, elite athletes. If you're in rehab, you're on a strict non-alcohol ban.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you said, we're not talking about a couple of beers here and there. We're talking about if you play on a Saturday and go out and get hammered, and you do that every Saturday, then you're you're going to have a few more niggles and bumps and bruises, and you're not going to recover as well, and you're going to struggle a bit more than if you'd been a little bit more moderate on your drinking.
I mean, I've played with guys who are adamant that they perform better once they've been on the night out before the game, and to be honest, sometimes they're accurate. They have performed better.
I must
just
admit,
because the anxiety levels, they probably don't overthink it as much, and a little bit more relaxed.
In my early days as a footballer, there was probably, I reckon, there's probably four or five times where I've drunk the night before a game, and regretted it because you wake up with a bit of a headache and you're a bit dry and all that sort of stuff. But sometimes you feel like you can run all day, you know, when you've had been drinking the night before.
Well, it's like, you know, we've all had
carb loading.
Got a little bit, you know, had a night out, and it's easy to run after the taxi or the train, or you just feel like you can run for ages.
Yeah.
You're just not thinking about it.
But then you need to sleep for
a
week.
Then the crash comes.
Yes. And then the crash.
Yeah. I think that's really the point. The unfortunate thing in the world we live is that everything has to be black or white, and, you know, I know on a lot of the national teams now, it's just a blanket ban on alcohol. And one of the great things as a coach, one of the things I enjoyed the most was sitting down with one or two beers occasionally overseas with some of the coaches and just having a moment to share and chew through learnings. And that's where, you know, you really can get to the bottom of things at times. Now, maybe the fun police would say, why do you need alcohol to do that? Well, sometimes if you're in Italy and it's beautiful weather, you want to have a beer. Yeah. I just think it's moderation and it's common sense.
Yeah.
We can't keep making rules for people not to use their brains. Just be smart about it.
We keep coming back to moderation, I think.
Yeah.
Balance.
Balance.
Yeah.
All right, boys. I don't think we've shattered too many dreams out there after that conversation. I think probably most people, if they're honest with themselves, would know a lot of that stuff anyway. Yeah. And now it's just up to them to go and make the right decisions. And, of course, it depends on what level of football you play at and what your goals are, whether you're in it for fun or whether you're in it to actually win competitions or whether you're in it because you want to get so much better and climb up the leagues and play as high a level as you possibly can. So
I think team morale also, when you take that into consideration, I know, you know, if you've ever been part of a team, sometimes the closer you come is when you've gone out and, like Bill said, had a couple of drinks and had better conversation. And
100%.
It's amazing how some at the local level, you hear about teams that, you know, go out together on the night out, before games, after games, and they go on to win promotion. Yeah. Obviously, that has its tipping point.
Yeah.
But because they're so close, they all, you know, they work hard together and they have success.
Yeah, it's just in moderation.
Yeah.
And often after a game, if you've had a win, the president or the someone on the committee will bring a couple of cartons of beer into the change rooms and, you know, it all kicks off pretty quickly. Anyway, we're going to take a break. After the break, we're going to chat to Associate Professor Anthony Licht of the James Cook University up there in Townsville. And he's written a recent paper called Key Team Physical and Technical Performance Indicators of Team Quality in the Chinese Super League. And we'll have a bit of a chat to him about that. This is the High Performance Show on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Alhaj Diouf at pace. Watch the movement of Phil Wood to the far post.
He rose so high.
The High Performance Show with Chris Appleford, Bill Tate and Keegan Ziata on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Welcome back to the High Performance Show. So far on today's show, we've spoken about David Astori, the Fiorentina captain who died a couple of weeks ago of a heart condition and what the likely causes of that might have been. And then we shattered every bloke's dream by telling him how bad alcohol is for sports performance and recovery. I think at the end of it, we just got to the point where everything in moderation and you'll be okay. Now we're going to cross to James Cook University in Townsville. We're going to chat to a man who has just finished a research paper with some co-authors called Key Team Physical and Technical Performance Indicators of Team Quality in the Chinese Super League. His name is Associate Professor Anthony Licht. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Mate, what was the goal or the purpose of your study?
What we wanted to do is we've seen quite a few other studies that have identified, you know, either physical or technical indicators for team performance, but no one's actually looked at these in combination. And also, no one's looked at these over an entire season. So we wanted to, you know, have a look at it from a coaching or even a player perspective of going, rightio, we all have this goal at the end of the season to be up in the top two or three teams to have a playoff opportunity. So what are the key characteristics that we really need to look at from a holistic point of view? So we really wanted to look at that, and we had an opportunity to do that within the Chinese Super League.
So how did you go about determining the results of your study?
So what we did is we were lucky enough to access a whole range of games. So during the Chinese Super League, there are about 240 matches played over an entire season. And what we did is we went through every single one of them and we coded. We were able to get access to the information from terms of how many passes, how many kicks there were, where they were, also how many metres that the players ran with or without the ball. So we were able to look at all these different characteristics from every single game over an entire season and then run through a whole range of different statistical analyses to come up with some idea of what actually it takes to succeed, you know, in the top four of the actual ladder, the next four, etc., but also compare the results for those teams that occur when they win, when they draw, and when they lose.
So what did you discover? What were the key performance, physical and technical indicators of successful teams?
So what we found in terms of physical, there weren't a lot of differences between teams, which is a bit surprising because we assumed that those who were running further, doing a lot more, would actually be the better teams. But we only found a couple of differences in terms of physical indicators. So the teams that tended to rank higher at the end of the season were those that actually did a lot more running in terms of sprinting during the actual competition itself, but also they were not necessarily doing a lot of running without the ball. So they seemed to be almost conserving their energy when they didn't have the ball, whereas the teams that sort of ranked lower, and particularly those right at the bottom, tended to do an awful lot of running when they didn't have the ball. So you could typically think that these people were actually chasing the ball around, trying to interact, trying to intercept the ball, and so obviously expending a lot of energy. Now, in terms of the technical demands, there's quite a few here that we identify, but I think probably the key ones were the fact that they obviously had the ball for a much greater proportion of the match. They were able to pass the ball into the final third of the opposition much more greater. And they were also able to win a lot of the 50-50 challenges. So the opportunities where two players were competing for the ball and neither had possession, those teams that actually ran better actually were able to succeed and win the ball and actually spend a lot more time with the ball itself.
What I got from the study, from reading the results, was those people without the ball, the players without the ball, who were smarter about where they should position themselves, so they had to do less running, tended to win more. Those who sprinted more and repeated sprints tended to win more. Would that be a fair summation of the physical side of things?
Very much so. So what you're seeing is that you're actually seeing some strategies being employed by players to know when to run, when to chase, when to conserve energy. But also we know that the game is improving. It's getting faster. The athletes are getting more athletic. But what we're noticing is those that are able to do it on a repetitive basis and at a high level tend to actually have greater ball possession and tend to actually score more and win. So what, you know, a lot of this information is sort of backing up some of the anecdotal evidence that we are improving, but we're actually now able to justify it over an entire season, not just one game, but over the entire season, and looking at different rankings at the end of the season. So if you're able to maintain the ball, you're either to run at a much faster rate and actually be smarter about when you run, when you conserve energy, then more likely you're going to succeed by the end of the season and be competing for championships.
So what I'm going to do as a coach is I'm going to go and find some smart footballers, a good combination of smart footballers who know where to be, and a good combination of athletes who can sprint repeatedly, and I'll be finishing on top of the ladder. One stat that I found actually really interesting was the notion of the 50-50 tackles. The team that wins more 50-50 tackles across the course of a season, in combination with the other factors that you mentioned, tends to finish near the top of the ladder.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, I suppose when you look at it from different coach perspectives, you might find that those teams that are more aggressive, those that are more physical, might be able to win a lot more of these balls. And that seems to suggest that those that are more aggressive, take a more offensive nature in terms of their play, might actually succeed to a much greater extent. Now, I've had discussions with others who suggest that defense wins games. And while I'm not going to deny that, I think what this data is showing us is that those that are more offensive-minded, more aggressive and physical to win these balls, are more than likely going to actually win games in the end. What's interesting is that we also looked at the number of yellow cards, the number of fouls committed, red cards, offside calls, etc., and there wasn't a lot of difference. So again, it comes back to being not only aggressive and offensive-minded, but being smarter, able to win the ball without excessive or unsportsmanlike type of play.
Why do you think they were the key indicators of success?
That's an interesting thought. Our original idea was that, in fact, a lot of the physical characteristics would be quite different. You know, we would tend to think that those teams that had more athletic players, those teams who are fitter, could run further, etc., would be the ones near the top. And what we found was, in fact, it's quite different. What that seems to suggest is that within this league, the teams are relatively very similar in terms of physical conditioning. And that might be because of the type of league itself, it might be the personnel, etc. What was, I suppose, a little bit unsure about was the technical demands. And it may suggest that this league here is actually more differentiated because of those technical demands. Again, that may be related to the coaches. It may also be related to the type of foreign players that are playing in these leagues as well, is they may actually be bringing in strategies and different techniques that are then being impacted on the local players. And we've seen that in other leagues, particularly international leagues, both in Europe and South America. But we might actually be seeing something very similar. And we're actually doing a little bit of a sub-analysis at the moment to look at what impact those foreign players, sometimes they call imports, what kind of impact they are having on the league and the national players there within the league.
Anthony, you mentioned that, and this probably is a nice little intro, but you mentioned that it was done in the Chinese League, and obviously other leagues have different quality players and styles and speeds. Would the characteristics be different from league to league, do you think, or how much would they be be similar?
Oh, I suppose what we're finding is, you know, our results are a little bit different. There are some things, obviously, that are very similar. So, for example, in the English Premier League, you know, match ball possession is really, really important. You can assume that if you have the ball more often, then you're more likely to score. The other team is less likely to score and you're more likely to win, obviously, from that. So there are some similarities. There are also some differences. So the 50-50 ball possession wins, obviously, is a unique feature that we're seeing. Again, it may be related to the player quality. It may also be related to the differences between both foreign as well as national players, whereas in other leagues, that difference may not be as great. And you can imagine, you know, one of the key features for the Chinese Super League is they're developing over time. So they may not have the elitist athletes from other areas, but they're actually developing. And so we might see a greater difference between that. But what was really keen, I think, from our point of view, is that, in fact, we were able for the first time to really differentiate this league in complexity in terms of comparisons with other leagues. Other leagues have only done small studies looking at particular components. What would be really interesting in the future is then to undertake this very similar type of study in those to see how similar or not they are with the Chinese league. Now, obviously, there is a difference in quality or difference in level, difference in experience, by all means, but it's something that we want to look at in the future.
Hey, just one more before we let you go. Anthony, do you think that the findings that you have discovered in the Chinese Super League could transfer to local league here in Australia? I mean, a lot of our listeners play either local state league competitions, sort of community type competitions, or NPL, which is a league or two below our national league. Do you think it would be the same?
It's hard to say. I mean, some of these characteristics are very generic in terms of fitness level. My own personal feeling is I think the fitness levels between teams will vary depending on the number of players you have and the type. I would tend to think that there are some aspects of this that very much are applicable. So if we look at the aggressive nature, the offensive focus of some teams may actually be more advantageous. Now, that is going to be purely based on the personnel you have in your team. So I think one of the outcomes of our studies is to at least identify key areas that I think we need to focus on, particularly in talent development. So having the ability to repetitively sprint is going to be very key. And we've seen that not only in Australia, we've seen it in Europe, we're now seeing it in China. So we understand that that is very important. We understand that this offensive nature will also improve. And we're seeing very similar types of mentalities in other sports. So basketball, for example, in the US has become very much an offensive type of game. And if you can score many more goals or points than the other team, then you're more likely to win. And that style of play is changing. So the evolution of the competition itself also needs to be looked at. And I think we're now starting to see that probably in the Chinese league because they're taking an amalgamation of different leagues and different players. From Australia's point of view, I think part of it is also what type of player we have, where do we want to model, if we want to model after a European style, a Chinese style, a South American style, etc., and how do we improve our athletes through their talent development in terms of that? Do we need to focus more on technical skills? I would say that, in fact, there are aspects that we need to focus on in terms of being able to pass, in terms of winning against others without fouling, without employing yellow cards, etc. So that physical nature of the game, I think, is improving much more than it was, say, even 10, 20 years ago. So I think there's a lot here that we can actually apply to the local leagues. And we are starting to do it, I know, here in North Queensland. I've been discussing with the local leagues here in town about exactly how we can employ it with their juniors all the way up into their state league teams.
Sounds interesting. Anthony, thanks for being a part of our high performance show tonight. Really appreciate it, and best of luck.
Thank you very much. Congratulations. Love your show. Thanks.
Thank you there, Anthony Leake, Associate Professor Anthony Leake there, the Senior Sport and Exercise Science Academic at James Cook University. Fascinating study. We're going to take a break, boys. Right after the break, we're going to have our key takeaways from today's show. This is the High Performance Show on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
El Hans Diouf at pace. Watch the movement of Phil Wood to the far post.
He rose so high.
The High Performance Show with Chris Appleford, Bill Tate and Keegan Ziata on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Welcome back to the High Performance Show. Another big show, as always. We spoke about heart conditions on the back of the David Astori tragedy, the ex-Fiorentina captain who died of a heart issue a couple of weeks ago. Then we talked about alcohol and how that affects performance and recovery. And then we just interviewed Professor or Associate Professor Anthony Leake about the technical and physical performance indicators of teams that tend to end up at the top and bottom end of the ladder. Boys, key takeaways for today. We normally start with you, Bill, so let's start with Keegan today. What do you got for us?
Well, thank you very much, Kate.
Pleasure. It's a reward for, you know,
showing up.
Having a shirt on.
Cool. Takeaway from Anthony's discussion in regards to the technical, tactical and physical. Basically, technical and tactical affect the physical and vice versa, that, you know, at a certain point, once you're fit and at the higher you go, we talked about off air, probably more likely they become very minimal differences, then it's your ability to make good decisions and execute the technical side of it.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Bill.
Yes, I took away from today that you're on a mission to ruin everyone's Christmas by ruining everything good in the world.
Don't eat social lives. Don't drink beer.
Social lives, go on.
No, the same, but you mentioned, if I was a coach, this is what I'd do. You know, I was thinking about that as we're going along. I was thinking, okay, well, if I was coaching a team and it was lacking a little bit in football, you know, potentially what I'd be trying to say to them, I think often coaches will pull the push the button on work harder, work harder, work harder. And I know it sounds really obvious, but I'd probably be saying work harder when we have the ball and try and think just about position when we don't have the ball and try and conserve, which is a different message. So
yep.
I thought that was good.
The old saying, work smarter, not harder, almost. Yeah. Be smart with your movement.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And for me, it's just get your boozing under control, everyone.
All these people out there, all these Australians that are...
We just lost so many listeners today.
Stop getting hammered after a game and you'll feel so much better about your performance week in, week. No, go and get hammered. I don't care. Hey, thanks for joining the show, boys. As always, a wonderful show, and we'll see you again next week. Stick around. There's plenty more on FNR, but join us again next Wednesday evening from 6 until 7 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Savings Time for more sports sciencey stuff that will make you a better footballer. Stick around. Plenty more on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
El Hans Diouf at pace. Watch the movement of Phil Wood to the far post.
He rose so high.
The High Performance Show with Chris Appleford, Bill Tate and Keegan Ziata on FNR, Football Nation Radio.